At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not really about the processed food and consumer diet, you know, this Heinz Kraft deal. It's about the money, y'all. Lots and lots of money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 25th of March today, a Wednesday. Great, as always, to have you here, everybody. There is a quip to be made here, I'm sure, about what you get when you combine ketchup and, say, Cheese Whiz. I don't know. But we are not going to do that. No, sir. What we are going to do is talk about what will soon be the number 5 food and beverage company on the planet. Kraft and H.J. Heinz are merging, as you know. And they will sell, by the way, way more than ketchup and Cheese Whiz. But there is a far more interesting pairing behind this deal. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and the Brazilian private equity firm 3G. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains what they see in this Kraft Heinz company.
Mixing even the tastiest foods isn't always a good idea. Companies are the same. Donna Hittrich directs the private equity program at the Columbia Business School and says there's kind of a formula.
For a merger? Whatever you're going to be able to create more value than the companies could do on their own. I mean, that's the essence of it. But the devil's always in the details.
In this case, the details of cutting costs. That's how Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and Brazilian private equity firm 3G increased profit margins for Heinz after buying it in 2013. Anil Shivdasani is a professor of finance at UNC Chapel Hill.
3G is well known for a very, very stringent cost control.
With this deal, they plan to tighten Kraft's belt by $1.5 billion in the next 2 years. That's roughly 10% of the company's operating costs now. And Shivdasani says we shouldn't sugarcoat what that'll take.
I think there's no question that the issue of layoffs and headcount reduction is going to be front and center.
That's part of it.
Aaron Lash, analyst at Morningstar, says it's not all about firing people and spinning off snack brands.
You know, they're potentially more important to some of their suppliers, so they might be able to negotiate better terms.
They might get cheaper corn syrup, for example, now that they have ketchup and Cool Whip. But Columbia professor Donna Hittrich says all this accounting math only gets you so far.
My MBA students can do the math. The question is, who can exercise the leadership to make the math a reality?
She thinks this is where the people matter. And Warren Buffett, sage of Omaha, plus 3G, the drill sergeant of Rio de Janeiro, they make a formidable combination. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Formidable combination is not what anybody would call the Congress of the United States right now, but to Washington we go anyway, and budget season. Various and competing proposals are making their way through the legislative sausage factory, but lost sometimes in discussions of congressional budgets is this. It's not binding. It's a political document, a statement of principles, if you will, especially one principle in particular this year, how to get around the across-the-board spending cuts that we have come to know and love as the sequester. Yes, it's still around. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has the story.
Hanging over all these budget proposals and basically anything having to do with federal spending is the Budget Control Act of 2011, also known as the sequester. The government has managed to live under the spending caps it set for itself, kind of. Each year, spending was higher than the cap.
Defense has sort of a safety valve. It has these war budgets, which are not capped in the same way.
That's Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. That safety valve he's describing is the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund. The OCO Fund is for when America's at war, sort of like it is now with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. but it's being used to pay for other things like non-deployed soldiers' paychecks and benefits, even though it's not supposed to.
And then the question becomes, how far can you stretch the definition of what is an overseas contingency operation?
Todd Harrison, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, says all of this misuse of the OCO fund shows that many members want to spend more on defense and discretionary spending.
What that tells us is that no one is completely happy with the budget caps, but no one is willing to strike the compromise that would be needed to raise the budget caps or eliminate them.
Or as Brookings' Mike O'Hanlon put it.
So the bottom line is that everyone is ignoring a law that they actually know they can't ignore.
So the dance around the Budget Control Act will continue for now. Think of it as a lasting reminder of 2011, when the Tea Party was at the peak of its power and the deficit was at $1 trillion. Today, it's half that, but mostly thanks to increased tax revenue due to the recovery. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, somebody pushed the major indices downhill real hard right from the get-go, and they never really stopped falling. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our weekend show has been working on a project with the BBC World Service for the past couple of months, trying to find the answer to this question. How do you make it in this global economy? They've been to China and Nigeria and Germany trying to figure it out. And we'll have a couple of stories from here in the States in a couple of weeks. Today, though, we go to India. 9 out of 10 workers there, better than 90%, work in what's called the informal economy. Cooks and drivers and maids and street vendors. People who get paid in cash doing jobs that could evaporate at a moment's notice. So to answer the question again, how do you make it in a global economy? From Delhi, Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
Shri Ram sells papaya. He has a small wooden cart, 5 feet by 3 feet, and his business is simple. He buys papaya from a wholesaler and sells them to individuals in a neighborhood market. But in 2010, something happened that altered the course of Shri Ram's life. That year, India hosted the Commonwealth Games. Ram and the other vendors who sold in the market near the stadium were told by the Municipal Corporation of Delhi, the MCD, that they would be temporarily removed from their location, but they could come back after the games were over. But after the games, the MCD said Ram and the other vendors' licenses had been canceled.
So what happened was they went to the MCD to take up this issue that why our licenses have been cancelled. So those people told them that to keep coming. They kept telling them that, okay, fine, we'll tell you tomorrow. And finally they told them, fine, we'll give you your land back. You just have to pay 1 lakh in bribe.
The bribe that the MCD demanded of 100,000 rupees was at the time about $2,000. Just to put that in context, Shri Ram makes about $1,600 a year selling papaya.
So these guys all got together and they collected 30,000 rupees. So when they gave them 30,000 rupees, they made a form addressed to the police saying these guys are legal vendors, let them sit there and let them sell their food.
And at first, they were allowed back into the market. But when the vendors failed to raise the additional 70,000 rupees for the bribe, the authorities bulldozed their stalls. And because Shri Ram and many of the other vendors also lived on site, they lost their homes. Stories like this one are common among street vendors in India, according to NASFI, the National Association of Street Vendors of India. NASFI has roughly 500,000 dues-paying members. It has succeeded in having legislation passed. It provides low-interest loans to members, offers training, and organizes street food festivals with the Ministry of Tourism. It also helps vendors fight extortion. In other words, it creates a safety net for these informal workers. Here's Arvind Singh, the head of NASFI.
You talk to any vendor on the way, you know, they'll say they'll give to police, they give to municipality, they will give to traffic, they will give to the shopkeeper, they will give to anybody and everybody, you know, whoever gets an opportunity extorts money.
So how do you stop a situation like that?
One is definitely the organizing. If they're organized, that acts as a deterrent, you know.
And organizing is exactly what Shri Ram and the other vendors did. After their homes and businesses were bulldozed, they met with a prominent lawyer who offered to take their case pro bono. Right now, there is a stay that allows the vendors to sell at the market until the court reaches a verdict. And this whole experience, it changed Ram. He became an organizer. On a recent afternoon, Sriram took the day off to take me on a tour of Delhi to visit several of his fellow NASFI members, people he has helped. He led us into an East Delhi market through narrow passageways lined with stalls offering fruits and vegetables, pots and pans, fabrics, toys. At an intersection of two footpaths, we stopped at a small food stall. Only the tops of the cooks' heads were visible from behind giant pyramids of noodles and shredded cabbage, all of it glowing from the light coming through the bright yellow tarp that serves as the roof.
My name is Suresh.
I started my business out of a cart, and then I started investing a little more in my business, and then I put up a shop, and now I have a much bigger scale of operations.
Suresh's is what you might call a street vendor success story. He started small with a single dish he sold from a cart. Today, he has this shop with three tables and a full menu that includes traditional Indian dishes and Chinese food. On one wall of the shop is a certificate that Suresh pulled down to show me.
So the Ministry of Tourism, along with NASFI, organized this workshop where they certify you for street vending purposes and they give you skills like how would you budget, etc., etc. So this is a certification for that.
Suresh now has 10 employees. He makes a profit of 800 to 1,000 rupees, about $15 a day. That's pretty good wages in India. But Suresh still does not consider himself middle class, though he has been able to give his kids something he never had, an education. They're getting master's degrees, and he expects they will make it into India's middle class. This leap is crucial for the 92% of workers who exist outside the formal economy. They have no insurance and no pensions, and their businesses could cease to exist at any moment. Economist Jayashree Sengupta says if India's economy is to rise, it will have to create economic stability for people like Suresh, who are migrating from rural villages to cities so they can become a part of the consumer class, which, because India's population is so huge, has the potential to be the internal engine that drives the economy.
It's no point in, you know, depending on the export growth. We have a huge market of 1.2 billion people. So why not produce for the country?
And it's organizations like NASFI that have taken on the role of building the safety net needed to make that huge market a reality. In Delhi, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We've got a whole lot more from our series with the BBC about the global economy. It's called Six Routes to Riches at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
Since President Clinton, we've been selected by the White House to provide official pens for the president.
Because really, it's more than just any old signature, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. No, come on. Dow's off 292 points. You don't get the wah-wah trombones. What? 1.6% on the blue chips closed at 17,718. The NASDAQ off 118 points, 2.3%. Finished at 48.76. The S&P 500 gave back 30 points, 1.4%. Ended things at 2,061. Corporate news? Yeah, I told you about the Kraft and Heinz merger, right? Traders ate that news right up. Boom, boom. Shares in Kraft Food Groups shot up 35%. Lexmark International, which you maybe know for its printers, says it's going to buy Kofax Limited, which maybe you don't know for its enterprise software, stuff like programs that'll scan medical databases. Lexmark bumped up nearly 6% today. Kofax up 46%. The owner of the University of Phoenix, Apollo Education Group, said revenue fell for the 15th straight quarter, which is, if you do the math, divide by four, a long time. Shares of the for-profit education provider got poor marks, down 28%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a House subcommittee holds a hearing on prescription drug and heroin abuse. It's National Spinach Day. You remember the superfood spinach? You loved it before kale began its quiet, seemingly aloof advance on farmers' markets only to invade your home with its leafy green hipness. And tired of your day job? Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp Masters of Metal gets underway in Vegas. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The BBC, the television part specifically, not the radio part that we work with, suffered what could be quite a big financial blow today, and it was, to some degree, self-inflicted. The corporation fired one of its most popular stars, Jeremy Clarkson, one of the hosts of Top Gear, its motoring show, as the Brits might say. The show has a worldwide audience of more than 350 million people, including a whole bunch here. But the Beeb said it had no choice but to let Clarkson go after he was involved in what was called a fracas with one of his producers. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Top Gear is the world's most successful factual entertainment TV show, and Clarkson, the undoubted star.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Salivating over sleek, expensive cars.
Beautiful enough to cause dribbling.
Reveling in the power they can unleash.
And aggressive as well.
Trouble is, so is Clarkson, and it's proved his undoing. BBC chief Tony Hall fired him this morning.
Physical violence accompanied by prolonged verbal abuse has crossed the line.
Clarkson had punched his producer after subjecting him to a 20-minute expletive-laden tirade. The row was over the lack of a hot meal after a day's filming. Daisy Goodwin, a commercial TV executive, said Clarkson had to go.
Great presenters make programmes. On the other hand, I think that a broadcaster can never allow the talent to get bigger than the programmes.
Clarkson had been given many final warnings after a string of allegedly racist, homophobic and sexist comments on and off the show. But the BBC's decision to dump him could prove costly. Top Gear earns the corporation $75 million a year. That, says TV consultant Michael Clough, could be in jeopardy without Clarkson.
We would anticipate that it will be a challenge to create and continue the success which the show has had over the last decade.
What the unpredictable Mr. Clarkson will do next isn't clear. Other media companies may be wary about hiring such a hot property. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There are, when it comes to rail travel in this country, two ways that you really have to tell that story. The freight side of things, which is booming, by the way, and then passenger travel, which is growing, too, if not exactly booming. The thing is, there is only so much track to go around, which makes, as you might guess, for a whole lot of problems. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
There's something romantic about a train whistle. It makes you think about faraway places, adventure, lawsuits. Wait, what? Yeah, the jostling for rail space has actually made it all the way to the Supreme Court. Part of the problem is the way rail traffic is split up in this country. Privately held freight railways are thriving. Amtrak gets government subsidies, and it mostly runs on track owned by the freight lines. Delays peaked over the past few years for both passenger and freight rail.
Our biggest concern was our customers.
Ed Hamburger is president and CEO of the Association of American Railroads, a trade group for freight railways.
We move what Americans consume, what American manufacturers make, what American farmers grow.
Passengers should proceed to gate K, track 26.
Meanwhile, over at Amtrak, passengers were frustrated by all the delays.
We watched on-time performance plummet.
Jim Matthews is president and CEO of the National Association of Railroad Passengers. He met me at bustling Union Station in Washington. He says on some trains there were
5, 6, 7 hour delays.
Federal law says passenger trains get priority on the rails. Amtrak says that means freight trains should pull over for passenger trains. Matthews says that doesn't always happen. He says at one point, Amtrak's Capital Limited train from Washington to Chicago was late more than 90% of the time.
It had on-time performance in the single digits last summer.
The freight railways say they're often blamed for delays that aren't their fault. Delays caused by weather or accidents. They say they actually subsidize Amtrak because it uses their tracks, which they pay to maintain. Ed Hamburger again.
Last year, they spent $26 billion, private money. This year, they've announced plans to spend $29 billion.
And that lawsuit, the one that ended up at the Supreme Court, Amtrak scored a partial victory. But the case was kicked down to a lower court, and the legal fight continues. But court battles aside, here's the deal. Freight and passenger lines need to figure out how to share the rails.
The primary
issue between the freight and the passenger railroads is both have growing business.
That's Stephen Dittmeyer, adjunct professor of railway management at Michigan State University. He says you could build more track. The Passenger Association certainly wants the government to spend more money on rail infrastructure. The freight railways would welcome more government cash, but not if it came with more regulation. Dittmeyer says, let's think about what we can do now.
There can be ways to make sure that both get the time and space they need on the track.
Dittmeyer says freight trains could run on more set schedules, making it easier to coordinate them with strictly scheduled passenger trains. There's also a sort of air traffic control system in the works for our railways, designed to eliminate bottlenecks and improve safety. It was supposed to be finished by the end of this year, but is behind schedule.
Good morning, good morning.
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Five years ago today, President Obama put his signature on his signature piece of legislation, the Affordable Care Act. And he had a fancy pen to do it with, too. In fact, he had 11 pens, actually, one for each letter of his name. A.T. Cross is the company that supplies pens to the White House. Chad Mellon is the CEO. Mr. Mellon, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
How does one get to be the pen supplier to the president, as it were?
Well, I think it's a tremendous amount of history and a little bit of luck. The A.T. Cross Company has been around for over 169 years here in the United States. And really, since President Clinton, we've been selected by the White House to provide official pens for the president for a lot of his signing as well as gifting.
To give away to various luminaries, as it were.
Exactly. So there's really kind of two aspects to this. There is the actual bill signing where the president takes the pens that we provide, signs his name to enact the law. And interestingly, what he does is sign basically a letter of his name with each individual pen and then gives that pen to important sponsors and people that really help push the bill into his signature. And then the second thing is that the White House gives out mementos to people who come and visit, important people, and we participate in both those categories.
Is there a specific model or line of Cross pen that he uses? Do you know?
President Obama uses a black Townsend. That style of pen from us has been the choice of President Clinton, President Bush, as well as President Obama. So the last three presidents have all used a different type of Townsend pen, but still that same basic style.
Can I buy them retail?
You can't buy the president's pen retail, but you certainly can buy that style. It's a black lacquered pen with rhodium appointments.
And how much is it going to run me?
It's about $150.
For a pen? Or does he get like a gross for that?
No, that's a pen.
Wow. Do they buy them, by the way, from you, the White House, or do you give them to them?
No, they absolutely buy them from us.
Are there other notables who use your pen? I mean, you know, the presidents and prime ministers and queens and all that?
Sure. We're proud that Queen Elizabeth used our pen in 2013 to sign the Commonwealth Bill. Manmohan Singh, the ex-prime minister of India, was a very devoted cross user and had a cross sterling silver century pen. It's our thin pen in his pocket. And if you look at a lot of the pictures, you'll see that peeking out of his pocket. President Walker, who you might say, who's that? It's the president from House of Cards, used our pen to sign the education bill in the first season of House of Cards.
A little product placement there, right?
A little product placement. Yeah. But we have lots of, we like to call them thought leaders using the pen. And one of my favorite stories of our cross user is John Steinbeck. And we've got a letter in our archives. And John Steinbeck sent a note back to his editor saying that he's going to have to stop writing unless he can get some new cross pens and refills.
That's great. But you know, so that goes to a really interesting point. I mean, there is a certain visceralness to putting pen, actual pen, to paper. The Steinbeck story is a great example of that. But here we are now in an age where I've got an iPad and I take a lot of notes on it and I use a stylus or I use my finger. And are you worried about digital?
Yes, it's in our minds and we are absolutely looking at that. But I think the idea that handwriting is going the way of the buggy whip is not accurate. What we really see is a kind of a merging of what I would call traditional physical ink on paper with what you just described as the digital ink on a non-paper medium. And when those things are going to merge, and they're going to merge over the next few years, that's where we really see writing instruments and handwriting going.
Do you have a favorite model?
Personally?
Yeah.
Yes. I love our new Peerless product. It's even wider than the product that the president uses, and it's a big, meaty guy's pen.
And you probably get them for free, right?
I have a discount. I probably could hook you up, though.
Chad Mellon is the CEO of the AT Cross Company. They make pens for everybody, I guess. Mr. Mellon, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Guy.
This final note on the way out today, which will be either welcome news for those in the television business or maybe not so welcome news. I don't know. The head of Nielsen, the ratings people, told Bloomberg that by the middle of the year, they're going to start providing audience data for Netflix and Amazon Prime. Netflix, for one, has been notoriously vague about exactly how many people are watching, say, House of Cards. The numbers won't really matter all that much for Netflix and Amazon, other than prestige, I suppose, because they don't sell ads to support their programming. You pay the fee, as you know. But it is, I would bet, going to shake things up quite a bit, broadcast-wise. All right, we are out of here. We were somehow wah-wah tromboneless on this day when the Dow tumbled 292 points, 1.6%. The NASDAQ fell 118 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 gave back 30 points, 1.4%. Clearly, I'm going to have a conversation with some people. I don't know. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.